If you've got a Bible, turn with me to Genesis chapter 27 today. We are talking about my crazy family. When Danny asked about crazy families, I don't know why my wife pointed at me. I wasn't quite sure about that point. But today we're following the life of Jacob. Jacob is a significant character in the pages of the Old Testament. In fact, Jacob, if you remember from a week ago, we said that his life, it works like a Russian nesting doll. Have you seen one of these where you take the top off the doll and there's another doll that looks exactly like the one? Take the top off that and there's a miniature version and a miniature version and a miniature version. Only Jacob's life works with one layer of conflict after another. In the beginning of his life, he begins by having both a struggle and a quarrel with both his twin brother Esau and with his father. He moves to having a quarrel with his future father-in-law Laban. Then to having struggles with his wives, I said plural, yes, we're studying family based on a polygamous family, that's correct. And then he moves to a struggle not only with his wives, but to his eventual children. The interesting thing when you look at the patriarchs is you begin to see through the tunnel of time how the family traits, the dysfunctions can happen. In fact, what you're going to see is that the conflict from Jacob's family growing up with Isaac and Rebekah becomes part of the conflict in his family with his boys in the years to come. But now watch carefully the life of Jacob with me. For in this life, we're going to see something incredible. We're going to watch him from birth to death. We're going to watch this one man's life transform. We're going to see how in the earlier years, Jacob is a manipulator. He's a schemer, cold, and calculating, but through the transforming grace of God, he becomes a humble man. Genesis chapter 27, we pick up midway through the narrative, if you will, sort of scene three. There are seven distinct conversations in Genesis 27, and we're going to pick up in the third. We've got an elderly Isaac who is blind. We've got a wife, Rebekah, whom we're going to find is trying to trick her husband. We're going to see a disruptive, dysfunctional family we pick up beginning in verse 18, where the Bible says this. So he went into his father and said, "My father," and he said, "Here I am." "Who are you, my son?" And Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you've told me. Now sit up and eat of my game, that your soul may bless me." But Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you found it so quickly, my son?" He answered, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." And Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come near, that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you really my son Esau or not." So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. He said, "Are you really my son Esau?" He answered, "I am." And he said, "Bring it near to me that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it near to him and he ate, and he brought him wine and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." So he came near and kissed him, and Isaac smelled the smell of his garments and blessed him and said, now watch the blessing. "See, the smell of my son is the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May the God give you the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers. May your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you." As soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, when Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac his father, Esau his brother came in from hunting. He also prepared delicious food and brought it to his father. He said to his father, "Let my father arise and eat of the son's game, that you may bless me." His father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" He answered, "I am your son, your firstborn, Esau." And Isaac trembled. Note that word. He trembled very violently. And said, "Who is it then that hunted the game and brought it to me, and I ate it all before you came, and I have blessed him? Yes, he shall be blessed." And as soon as Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me, even me also, O my father." May God bless the reading of his word. The book of Genesis begins with the story of how all things came into being. But it quickly develops, and the story of Genesis begins to tell about how everything spirals downward, of how everything becomes into disrepair. It tells the story of human sin and rebellion, and no sooner had humanity made their entry into the world than we see a world that's in chaos, a world that is hurting, a world that is in pain. And then as Genesis moves, in the story of Genesis, if it were a movie, when it gets to this chapter 12, the story of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it hovers there. It stops right there. And it begins to tell the story of God's chosen family, of the family that he has chosen to change the world. You see, this family is the hope of the world. Would you say that with me? This family is the hope of the world. Now, there's a lot here in front of us. There's so much I couldn't cover in adequate detail. And so I want to invite you to take advantage of a new feature that we're doing in this series entitled The Extra Point. It's a playoff football and playoff sermons. Extra Point, you see it? It's good, isn't it? You like it, don't you? The creativity. Anyway, thank you for that. This week's Extra Point focuses on Esau because it matters who you marry. We won't have the time to get into that, but I invite you on all of our social media as you exit in just a few minutes. You're invited to go there. Now look with me. What I want to look at is the family for just a moment. And how many of you are old enough to remember the Brady Bunch? Okay, all right. A lot of lying people in here because you look old enough to remember the Brady Bunch, but maybe your memory's not all that good. If I'd had the pictures of all the family, if I could have put them on the screen, then I would have sang the Brady Bunch song for you. But since I don't have those, and I can't put, you know, those 3x3 tiles, can you see it? You know, the 9 of them? Since I don't have that, let me give you the fast analysis. Let me show you the major characters in today's story. There's 4. It begins with the father, Isaac. This is a patriarchal society. The Bible always reinforces male leadership in the family. Behind Isaac, who's both husband and father, comes Rebekah, whom the Bible calls very attractive. So attractive, she entices her husband at his fault to lie, to try to protect her in a deceptive way. Then we come to the 2 boys, the twins whom we met a week ago as we began this. The eldest son, maybe by a few minutes, we don't know exactly, Esau, and the youngest, Jacob. Here are our 4. This is our crazy family. In fact, as we look at this family, we see again it's God's chosen family. And if I might just in this fast analysis share with you a little bit of the character, a little of the personality. Isaac, as I mentioned a moment ago, is cool, calculating. He's a schemer. Whenever you meet him, he shakes your hand, the wheels are turning. At this point in his life, he's going to figure out how to get one up on you. Esau is sort of a more happy-go-lucky person. He is shallow, he is impetuous, he is temperamental, he is probably spoiled, he is a hunter's hunter. But probably if you had to work next to one of the two in a cubicle, you'd probably choose Esau over Jacob. Probably at this point in his life, if you worked with Jacob long enough, you might hit him. You get so angry with him. He's that kind of person that, you ever had somebody pull a scheme on you, but the supervisor never could figure it out? Have you ever figured that person out? That the boss, that, you know, your brother or sister, they could always pull something in the back bedrooms, and they'd come out just smelling just fine for the parents. Well, this is the kind of character these two individuals are. You know, if this family wasn't 3,700 years old, they'd be a reality television show. You know, Desperate Housewives of Ancient Israel kind of thing. Look at me, what I'm calling first, dysfunctional families are self-centered and insecurity-filled. Desperate families, dysfunctional families, are self-centered and insecurity-filled. Let me show you some of the rift in this family. I've spent the week studying this passage, though I've known it in the past. I didn't get into the detail of it. There are 7 venues of conversation in this chapter, 7. But in every conversation, every scene, no conversation has more than two people in it. There's never three people talking. There's never a time when all four are talking. Even though we're introduced to Esau's wives, they're Hittites in the earlier part, the latter part of 26, as well as in the chapter 28, never do we see the family together. It's almost as if every time they're getting together, they're in corners whispering to one another about others. In fact, this family has such a disruption, such a rift in it. We find that Rebekah is eavesdropping on her husband. Now that tells you something. She knows that something's afoot. So here are four people in a family, yet no time do all the four get together. I wonder what would it look like had they gotten not in the corners of a room, but got together in one room and had sort of a family conversation. This family is so disruptive. I didn't read this a moment ago, but look with me at verses 5 and 6 of Genesis 27. Chapter 27, verses 5 and 6. Now pay attention here to the personal, or what I should say, the possessive. I should say possessive pronouns. Look at this. Now Rebekah was listening to Isaac when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. Whose son? Now is that just his son? It's her son too, isn't it? Now keep reading. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, look at verse 6. Rebekah said to her son Jacob, isn't Jacob also Isaac's son? You see, what you have here, before we really get into the detail of the blessing and the birthright, you have essentially like a family who's gone through a divorce proceeding, and there's two twins, and the one, the mother says, well, I'm going to have custody of him, and you'll have custody of this other one, and they've just sort of staked out their turf. Like they put caution police tape down the middle of the house and says, no, this is my side. Don't come over here. This is my boy. This is a dysfunctional family with a capital D. Now, to get into this, we've got to talk about this thing called the blessing. Because maybe you're like me as you read this thing. I wanted to scream at my Bible. I wanted to scream through the years at Isaac. I'm, for better or for worse, sort of a hands-on dad. And if one of my boys had pulled this stunt with me, you know, if I get really old and I can't see and they've deceived me, I would pull them close, probably by the earlobe. Say, come here, let me talk to you. And I would say, you think you can get one over the old man, do you? Well, I revoke everything I said to you a moment ago. Isn't that what you want to do when you see this? You say, I don't get this. Now, this is part of the disconnect between our culture and their culture. This is part of the disconnect in the 3,700 years between they and us. Because when a father would give this blessing, it was done probably at the end of his life or at the time when he was about to leave the family, one of those two. And as you can tell in the narrative, it's irrevocable. It couldn't be pulled back. As much as I wanted, and you and I may want Jacob to get his due here, it's irrevocable. There's a couple things you need to be aware of this. This blessing is highly valuable. The word blessing in English is really a wimpy word. It doesn't carry the strength that it needs to. When we think of something as a blessing, we think of just sort of something really nice. You know, that apple pie was a blessing to my day. The doorman was a blessing. He was kind to me. Or it was a blessing to drive through a lack of traffic. It's just something sort of an add-on in life. But you can tell how valuable it is because, look, Rebekah and Jacob conspire to steal it. Esau is so angry that he was pilfered the blessing, that he's so angry he's going to kill his brother. He's going to become the second Cain in the book of Genesis. And Isaac, I'll get it right. I do the same thing with my kids. One of you kids, come here. You knew who I'm talking about. Isaac, look at this. He is so eager to give it. This is a valuable thing. The ancient people knew something that we don't understand, and that words are powerful. If there's a lesson to be taken away from today, and we'll come back to this, is that the power of a mother and father's words spoken over a child. Even though we want to say to Jacob, take the blessing back, your son's a fraud, he's a crook, pull it back. But an ancient narrative like this speaks of something powerful, the words of a mom or a dad. In fact, one Hebrew scholar who comments on this passage says, and I quote, "The narrative presumes that symbolic actions have genuine and abiding power, that spoken words, especially of a parent to a child," mark that, "spoken words, especially that of a parent to a child, shape a human life. Words here are not a matter of indifference, which may be attended to or is not convenient." You know, counselors and therapists today know what the ancient people knew, that the words of a mom and dad are so valuable, so valuable. I wonder if you and I recognize the power of our words. I wonder if we as parents recognize the power of our words, the words of a father, and how he may shape the generations to come. Do you realize that your parents' words have shaped you, for better or for worse? This birthright is at the center of this family struggle at the moment. I find it interesting a couple things. It's interesting that even though Esau is so angry by the end of the chapter that he could kill Isaac, has he conveniently forgot that he gave it away for the price of a meal? It's amazing what we choose to remember, isn't it? And I see something fishy going on here with Isaac, the father. You see, he tells whom he thinks is Esau, but essentially is Jacob, that it's near the end of his life, and he's got to give this right now. But by accounts, he lives some two decades or longer past this. I find that fishy. What's going on here? Now, you may say, Pastor, haven't you known people that think they're going to die, and then they live many years after? Okay, grant that. But watch this. Pay attention to this. Most of the times in the pages of the Bible, when a blessing like this is given, the entire family comes together. Do you know a good Jewish family? Do you know how they do a bar mitzvah, how they gather everyone? It's a celebration. That's what would have gone on here. When Isaac was to do this, it wasn't in a corner someplace. It wasn't just between two. He would have brought the entire family together. They would have had a meal together, and there would have been a sense of celebration. There's something fishy going on here. You know what I think is happening? I think that the blind, physically blind Isaac is spiritually blind. You know why? Because he is purposely forgetting the words stated over his twins when they were born. Do you remember them from a week ago? Genesis chapter 25. Look at verse 23. I hope you'll see it on the screens with me. This is what God said of these two boys, these twins. Two nations are in your wombs, and two peoples form from within you. Shall be divided, the Bible says here. The one shall be stronger than the other. Now pay attention to this. Look at this next part. Look at this, he says. He says this next part here. The older shall serve the younger. Isaac is spiritually and physically blind. He is fading spiritually in life. Look what he does. When he plays favorites with Esau, he picks Esau because this next passage, we saw this a week ago, we'll see it reinforced today. In Genesis 25, verse 28, Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. Now, I've been told the way to a man's heart is through where? His stomach. And I want to say that I've had two great meals this week of barbecue to the praise and honor and glory of Jesus. And may I also add that Texas barbecue beats barbecue from other places. May I just say that? Now, as good as the barbecue was, to deliberately disobey God, like this father is doing, over his taste of a meal. You know, I also find interesting, I don't have time to develop this, but Rebecca, she knows her husband. She knows him well. She can take domestic game and dress it up and make it appear as if it's wild game in the palate of her husband. Wonder how many times she's heard him complain or speak praise of a meal. I don't have time to pursue that. There's a lot of fishy things happening here. This is a family adrift. Now, I need to remind you of something really important. That this is not an ordinary family. Not just because they're in the pages of the Bible, but this is the one family God has chosen to change the world. You see, Jacob, who's our focus, back with his grandfather Abraham, a promise was given. We looked at this a week ago, and I want to repeat it here so we all grab it. Genesis 15, verse 5. Can we read it together? You ready? And he brought him outside and said, "Look toward heaven and number the stars, if you're able to number them." Then he said, "So shall your offspring be." That is a foundational covenant promise made to Abraham, the grandfather of Jacob. But not to be outdone, Isaac gets the same thing. Several chapters later in Genesis 26, verses 3 and 4, here the same promise repeated to his boy, to Isaac. Look what he says here. You ready to read it? Let's read it together. "Sojourn in the land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your offspring I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father." Keep reading. Next slide now. "I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and will give to your offspring all these lands." Everybody together, this next part. "And it was stated to the grandfather Abraham, it was stated to the father Isaac, and it was repeated now to Jacob. Listen as I read this now. "Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north and the south, and you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed." This is the one family that God has sort of put his hand on and chosen. As the New Testament opens in the first book and the second verse, middle school students, the first book and the second verse, the Gospel of Matthew, it is said of Jesus that he is born of the family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is no ordinary family. God chose this family to change the world. Dysfunctional families are self-centered and insecurity-filled. But look at this second thing. Thriving families are Christ-centered and grace-filled. Christ-centered and grace-filled. What are we to learn from this family? What are we to learn from the pages of the Bible? Well, there's two or three lessons here I want to pull together sort of in conclusion. First, this is real simple. Don't be like these parents. Don't parent like Isaac and Rebekah. They played favorites. They played favorites. They pitted the children against one another in a tug of war in marriage. But secondly, I want to pause here. Recognize the power of blessing your children. Recognize the power of blessing your children. Have you ever had someone to bless you, to look at you and through the Spirit of God, to discern your giftings and your personality and look deeply into you and to recognize your nuances and to say how blessed both you are and they are because of you. I grew up from a tough dad, a dad that loved me, but I mean, he just spoke truth, and sometimes he wielded truth like it's an army sergeant. To get a flavor of my dad, and this worked for me, okay? This was a statement I would hear as a teenager. "Your blank is grass, and I'm the lawnmower." Okay? No nuance there, is there? He learned that in Vietnam in his boot camp, so I was the recipient of that. And oftentimes when I was, before I had kids, we all know what to do when we don't have kids. We all know how to parent really well back then. And then we get kids. And I would look at a kid that was misbehaving at school or at church, and I would say, you know what, they don't have parents that really, they're spoiling that kid. Somebody needs to take that child aside and speak directly to them, among other things. And perhaps, but you know what I've learned through the years? Oftentimes those problem kids at school don't have a mom or a dad that would speak right in their soul and say to them, "I love you. Your mother and I, we're incredibly blessed to have you. You're out of this world intelligent. I could see your giftings. You're going to be a great speaker. You're going to be a great," and to recognize their skill and to speak how important they're going to be in the days to come. Mom and dad, the power of your affirmation, the power of your words. I found myself several years ago with one particular child of ours. I felt like I was continually criticizing. And I was reminded that leadership in workplace says that if you're going to say one negative, you'll at least say at least three positives. This is something powerful here. And let's be truthful about Jacob for a moment. There's not a lot right now in Jacob. You're not catching Jacob on his best day. Jacob needs to be taken out back in the woodshed, even though he could be my age or older at this point. This is no teenager in front of us. He didn't just get the keys to the car. He's a schemer. He's a manipulator. I want to ask you a question. I don't want you to respond out loud, but I want you to think about it. Do you think that the blessing from Isaac changed Jacob? Do you think it changed him? I don't think it did. Here's why. I think when Isaac potentially, you know, he pulled him in close, when he took his son, and he pulled him in perhaps as close as my hands are to me, and maybe he had whom he thought was Esau, but he had Jacob right there, and he looked right into his eyes. Jacob would have realized the blessing was not really his, but it was Esau's. He says as much in the beginning when he speaks about his son's smell, his ability to hunt the field. This was a deeply personal thing. Even though Jacob got the words that he wanted, that he knew they weren't his. But I wonder in that moment with Jacob, in this lesson, I wonder what it was like to have the look that he wanted from his father. Don't you know that the affirmation, the approval, men, and I'm calling you out, dads, men, don't you know that Jacob longed for Isaac's approval? I think Jacob hunted in the field not because he liked it, but because he thought that was the way to get his dad to approve of him. Don't you think that when Isaac had Jacob there and he saw the look from his father, that was the look he'd always wanted? And even though it was that close, he knew it was miles apart. The first lesson we learn is don't parent like these parents. Learn the power of your words. If you've ever been blessed like this, you will never forget it. By the way, you cannot convince me that the crisis we have in sexuality in this nation is not at its heart of the affirmation and the love of a parent. The second lesson we learn is the sovereignty of God. You may not know that word. You may not embrace that word. Let me just say it this way. The control that God has of ordinary affairs. You may have missed it. I did till later in the week. It happens in verse 33 when Isaac recognizes who he's speaking to. When he recognizes the deceit of everything, Moses, who writes Genesis, says that the father shook. But didn't just say he trembled. He shook violently. It's one thing for me to have the flu and have the chills and to shake. It's another thing to shake and to convulse. Had you been there, you'd have run to the father, this old man who may have been as much as 120 years of age at this point, and you would have tried to console him and to bring him. You know what he was shaking about? Not just because he'd been deceived. I'm sure that was part of it. This man was shaking because he had willfully disregarded God's will. He knew exactly who God had chosen among his boys. He knew that Jacob was the chosen one. He knew the will of God, and yet he tried to spurn the will of God for the price of a meal, for the good taste of great food. You may not be familiar with this phrase. It comes from the New Testament, the book of Acts in chapter 9, speaking of a man named Saul's conversion, who later became Paul. It comes from the old King James, 1611. It says, kicking against the goads. It's like taking on the whole football team. You just can't do it. And when you take on God, when you run from him and when you rebel from him, the truth is you can't run fast enough or far enough, and you cannot box with God. That's what Isaac learned. that God's will happen. There's one more lesson I want to conclude with, and it's right here. The New Testament, when it puts a portrait of grace up, if the New Testament had a wallet, especially Paul, and you said, Paul, would you show us what the grace of God looks like? Paul would reach in and he would show you a picture of Jacob. Jacob doesn't deserve this blessing, doesn't deserve this grace, but the grace will come to him at the end. You see, the truth is that God can bring great things from broken families. And God specializes in redeeming a mess. You know, most of you think that religion, what we're doing right now and what I do, you think religion is a ladder. And you're climbing the ladder, rung by rung, trying to get to heaven. Good works, treating the poor right, listening to this boring sermon, going to Bible study, you know, giving a little money at church, trying to wake your way up to heaven. And one day you hope that you're going to be right there at the end of life, knock on the door, and he lets you in because of all the good works you've done. But see, when Jesus came along, Jesus said the ladder doesn't go from heaven, doesn't go from earth to heaven. The ladder reverses the different way. It goes from heaven to earth. And it's not religion. Religion says man can go up to God. Christianity and Jesus said God comes to man. Let me show you the way Jesus would show it to you. Trace and I have had 4 mortgages in our lifetime. And I remember the first mortgage, the first time we did it. I don't think I was out of my 20s as of yet. We bought a house over South Fort Worth, $63,500. 6.25% interest rate. 30-year note, put 3% down the FHA note. Have you ever done that? Have you ever gone through those mortgages like that and you sat in the bank? I was so confused. I was so green. I was so new to the whole thing. I didn't know what we got closing. We're just putting paper upon paper upon paper, signing things, inspection, all this kind of stuff. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. But I felt very nervous because I knew that by the skin of our teeth could we afford that house. And I didn't want them to open up and overturn too many rocks because you know what they're doing in a mortgage? They're looking at you. They're about to give you a tremendous sum of money. But they're looking at you and saying, can you pay for this? Can you pay this back? Over the life of 30 years or 15 years, can you pay this back? That's the way a bank would give money. That's the way religion works. But watch how a good parent works, a good father and a good mother. I've never sat and calculated the amount of money that my parents have given me, but there was never a bill for rent. Nobody ever billed me for the morning meals and the evening meals. Nobody ever billed me for my college education. That just was handed to me for free. They never looked at me and said, hey, Scott, come here. Are you worthy of this investment? Can you pay this back? Don't you see the way God does? God doesn't give money like a bank. He gives money like a good parent. God is looking at you with the tremendous life-transforming grace of God. You don't deserve His mercy, but you come and receive His mercy. That's what the cross of Jesus is about.